Hello, and welcome to Dig It. I'm Peter Brown, and hosting the show with me today is Chris Day. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Peter.
April in the garden. Spring is definitely here, isn't it, Chris?
And I'd say, Peter, it's a bit earlier than it normally is, if that makes sense.
It's odd. I was looking out in the garden the other day, and I've got daffodils and tulips in flower at the same time, and yet my bluebells haven't started flowering yet. What's going on?
Very, very strange, isn't it? I've got similar in some of my pots as well. And in fact, a lot of the daffodils are coming to an end now, which is somewhat earlier. Certainly the smaller flowered ones. But yes, it is very... I mean, my grape hyacinths are doing what they normally do at this time of the year. So they're about on track.
But yeah, they're looking really good. I must say, I picked a fair few of my neighbours grow them in their front gardens, and they're looking really good this year, aren't they?
They are, but I think we've found a few issues, haven't we, with the bulbs, as well as enjoying them a little bit earlier. Our slimy friends have been taking a bit of a fancy to them.
Slugs and snails have been munching a bit, but well, certainly my tulips have been attacked. But it's good to feed them something, I suppose.
It's a bit disappointing, though, isn't it, when you see amazing blooms, and especially I noticed on some of my double narcissi, which are huge flowers anyway, so how they have the audacity to walk clamber up and then have a nibble, but I suppose that's nature, isn't it?
So. Definitely. Now, Chris, there's something we talked about, I think, before, about making your daffodils come back better and stronger next year by sort of cutting the flowers off. At what point, I mean, how do you know when a daffodil's sort of flower is about ready for cutting off, and how would you do it? Is it secateurs that you chop them down with,
or I mean, secateurs or some shot, if you've got some snippers, if you use snippers in the garden, a lot of us use those these days. But when the flower is definitely fading and it's definitely withering, and I suppose if you've got you know daffodils in a clump, they're all going to be at about the same sort of stage when that happens. But enjoy them, and then when they start to look a little bit raggedy, then go along, trim them back, and remember, just take the flower off and just below where the seed pod would be, so you still leave the long stalk.
I was thinking you're gonna have to get back to the base of it, but no, you can leave it just the first couple of inches beneath the flower.
That's it,
sort of where the, I don't know what you call it, the sort of seedy bit is, and then chop it off there. That's good, brilliant.
And that, like I said, the reason we leave that long stem on is that will then nourish the bulb, as well as the leaves sort of gradually dying back, so will the flower stem, and then that will give the plant a little bit of oomph for next season.
Excellent. I'll try that this year, because I want my bulbs to start really bulking out a bit more, and I guess hopefully that will help them, will it?
It certainly will. Should do.
Brilliant. Yes, okay. What we got going on, and have we got any good events to go and visit?
It is April still, so we're starting to see a few things cropping up. The 6th and 7th of April, if you're down in the lovely part of Cornwall, the Garden Society have their spring show.
Right.
And it's held at the Royal Cornwall Showground. And it's got lots of things, lots of dazzling displays. And this is apparently, it's a big thing for Cornwall anyway. It's their main spring show. So have a look. We'll put the website details, as always, on our show notes for people to find out more.
Brilliant, thank you.
Yeah, and then there's quite a lot of this going on because we're into flowering cherry season. It's the Hanemia Blossom Day.
Okay.
So that word I've discovered is the great thing about doing this podcast, Peter, is we do learn stuff ourselves, don't we?
Which definitely, is so all the time. All the time. Well, some of us more than others as well, Chris.
Anyway, the word means the Japanese tradition of viewing and admiring cherry blossom. So I'm sure we're doing that. We're already doing that at the Garden Centre here, because we've got some amazing flowering cherries looking so good in some of the areas of the Garden Centre. So this is this is at Brogdale, which of course Brogdale's famous for its fruit. This is over in Faversham, and they're having a whole day on Saturday the 13th of April to celebrate Blossom Day. And there's going to be a lot of discover sort of Japanese art and culture. Obviously, you can go and have a look at the wonderful blossoming orchards. It's quite an immersive experience, actually. Lots of things to do and see. So, including amazing Japanese drumming and sword display. So, my word.
That's proper a, day out there.
Yeah, perhaps some new forms of pruning there, maybe. I don't know. But it sounds good, and good for Brogdale. It's always a good destination. And you mentioned about good old bluebells. On the 15th to the 28th, there's a celebration of blossom to bluebells at Hever Castle down in Kent.
Okay.
So it's a whole sort of fortnight of celebrations. And I suspect with the very mild spring we're enjoying, there'll be plenty to see.
Mm-hmm.
18th to the 21st of April, a gardening show we've been mentioning quite a lot, Peter, on the podcast. That's the Royal Horticultural Society's Urban Show.
And yep.
It's a first. This is the one set in the heart of Manchester at the depot in Mayfield. And
okay.
It's all about... They're billing it as a new immersive experience, so it's going to be all about indoor plants and using smaller spaces. So that sounds really good. So that's a 3-day show starting on the 18th. And then on the 21st of April, we've got one of these plant fairs at Arundel Castle. We're going to all the castles this month over in West Sussex, and that's between 10 and 5. Obviously, proper nurseries there displaying their plants in the wonderful gardens of Arundel Castle.
Okay.
And then finally, on the 29th of April, Rachel Detaine, famed obviously for her appearances on Gardener's World, is at the Garden Museum in Lambeth in London, and she's going to be talking about a flower garden for pollinators. It's a talk in correlation to her new book coming out. So,
yeah.
Yes, a good old book launch. That's always good to do.
Yeah,
which, she's working with a botanical artist, Lauren Lusk, on this new book. So, yeah.
Nice and interesting. Good stuff.
Yeah, so plenty to do. Very diverse month, I think, before all the flower shows really kick in next month.
And for our local customers, Chris, can you... And we were talking about bluebells earlier. I love going out in the spring and going to a good bluebell wood. I think... For me, one of the best ones around here is up near Silverstone, Hazelborough Woods. I just love it in the spring. The beautiful carpets are blue. And have you got any favourites that you like to go and walk around?
Yeah, the one local to the garden centre here and under the Woodland Trust, of course, is Collegewood. Although it says it's near Nash Bletchley, it's more sort of Milton Keynes, and it is just like, but it's really good. It's got a fantastic. It's about 50 acres, so it's a big old area.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd say Hazelborough's more like 5 acres or so. But not that all of that is bluebells.
No, I'm going to say this is quite expansive, but perfect opportunity to go and see them as they come in and do their wonderful thing, and they do make some amazing. You get some amazing photography in those woods.
I think that's it. And they're generally, you find them in sort of, dare I say it, native woods.
Yeah,
sort of deciduous beech woods. And you get so much light in those sort of woods. It's a lovely environment.
Yeah, indeed. Especially if you go sort of early morning or later on in the afternoon where the sun started to go down and you can... Yeah, do some lovely pictures.
Definitely. Excellent. Okay, so that brings us on to the news. What's in the news at the moment then, Chris?
Right. Well, we'll start with trees. We often start with trees. The first story, actually, which I've not put onto our running order, it came up on my Facebook this morning, is the Woodland Trust. There's a story on there protecting their 550-year-old Darwin Oak, which we mentioned a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
Apparently, the other weekend, over 100 Charles Darwin lookalikes went along to protest, and they were all dressed as Charles Darwin with very surreal masks on to get the message. But this is all because of this relief road in Shrewsbury, which is causing all sorts of problems. And apparently, if it goes ahead, there's going to be, I think, 9 trees going to have to come out. But the fact that they went in fancy dress to protest was quite
brilliant.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, it gets them on the news, gets them a bit more coverage.
It does
it?
Indeed, and then, of course, the tree of the year. We mentioned this a little while back, but the results are in now. And
this is the global tree of the year. The best tree in the whole world.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so where is the best tree in the whole world?
Well, you're going to have to go over to Europe. You're going to have to go to Poland, to be exact.
Okay.
And there's an amazing specimen of the European tree, and it's a beech. It's a common beech tree.
Okay.
And it's huge. It's at the University of Wrocław Botanical Gardens.
Right.
And it's huge, and it is massive. I mean, it's over 200 years old, this beech tree, so it's big, but it's expansive. There'll be pictures. We'll do a link, because there's pictures for this on the BBC News website.
Okay. And is it a green beech or a purple
beech? It's a green beech, I would say, from the description, yes.
Fair enough. Yeah.
In the second place, there's a weeping beech. There's a theme going on here, right. In Normandy.
Okay.
And that spreads over 40 metres wide.
I don't think I can picture a weeping beech. I can picture the upright. Yeah. What are the pole ones?
Yeah.
You get fastigiate beeches, mm-hmm. which are they're like sort of totem poles, aren't they?
But
this is the exact opposite then. It's a weeping.
It is, and it just rose across there. And obviously and it actually provides... in the city, a load of, obviously, wonderful shade. You know, 40 metres of shading, isn't it? The biggest parasol.
That sounds brilliant. Yeah. Can we get a picture of that?
Yeah, that'd be
have to go to France and have a look at that one then.
Yeah,
do we sell them, though, Chris?
We don't, I don't think. I will check on that, actually.
I don't think I've come across it. Sounds like an interesting one. Brilliant. Yeah.
And the third place, we'll give... you have to go to Italy now. It's getting even better now, isn't it? And this is a 1,000-year-old olive tree.
Wow.
And that's estimated between 4,000 years old. So they reckon it's one of the oldest. It's in Sardinia, by the way, in Italy. So, aged trees, but what diversity? But beech again, you see, it's a common denominator, isn't it? Yeah.
Well,
it's a good tree.
And it's good news for the sycamore gap tree.
It is. So. If you remember, this is the 300-year-old tree, which was obviously what they call an unforgivable act of vandalism back in it was last September, wasn't it?
Mm.
So yes, there's a lot of propagation been going on, Peter, just to try and get some genetics back into the new plant, which will hopefully replace it. So
have we heard whether the stump has suckered or?
I think we'll probably have to wait till this spring, actually, for that, won't we?
Yeah, it's not far away now, then.
No,
potentially,
I mean, anytime.
It'll send up some sprouts soon, then.
Yeah, they've been doing, obviously, there was saved seed from the tree, historically, so they're obviously working on that, and they have been looking at other forms of propagation, maybe doing a bit of grafting, too. So
That's good news, then. Brilliant. So maybe they can replant the original tree back where it started.
Yes, indeed.
300 years ago.
It would be wonderful when that happens, won't it? Yeah.
And an article I saw in the news which really made me giggle is the Californian redwood.
Mm.
We've got more of them in England than they have in California.
I know. I did it for double sake. So basically there's 500,000 in the UK compared with only 80,000 in California. Although I suspect those 80,000 are going to be pretty big.
They're probably, I can remember one from my childhood that it was always a lovely tree. The texture of the bark when you're about, I would say, 7, 8 years old, sort of going and peeling little bits off. It was just such a soft, lovely tree, but enormous. I mean, I think the one that I used to go and play underneath was, I'm going to say, 30, 40 metres tall, which... is nothing in comparison with how big they can get, is it?
And I think what always makes me slightly aghast is the fact that the stem, the actual trunk, is just so straight.
Mm.
It's almost like it's like an actual piece of structure, you know, not a living thing. It's so perfect.
Yeah,
the way
they're
it grows.
Great.
Yeah.
And they're such majestic tree, aren't they? They always tower above all the others in the wood. Yeah, so.
And the fact is, the plant was introduced by the Victorians, so, you know, we would have had probably a lot more if that had happened earlier, you know. So, so they were obviously key in bringing the seeds over here and propagating. So you will see a lot of them around. So if you're going on, you know, this spring and summer, you're going to any national trusts or any major gardens, you know, maybe try and check out a Western cedar if you can.
And I also see in the news plastic grass or artificial grass is not going to get banned.
So this all comes from, Peter, this House of Lords report on the gardening industry, which I think everybody's a little bit disappointed in the gardening world because it's sort of been slightly dismissed.
So it seems like we've got a bit brushed over, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure in the scheme of Parliament and the way politics works, it's maybe not seen, but we know how important horticulture is. I mean, how much money it brings great jobs, and you know, and, yeah. it's worth, you know, a heck of a lot of money to the economy of all areas of horticulture, whether that's agriculture, growing, or you know, growing plants and you know, garden centres. So,
and also the health of the nation. I mean, yes. You think how many people who get into gardening get fit, and mental well-being and all that side of things. I mean, it's a great hobby to have, and yet it's being so brushed under the carpet, as it were.
Or under the artificial lawn, maybe.
Yeah.
But no, they're saying that the government have no plans to ban pesticides, as they remain a vital tool for farmers and landowners. Yet they've been told to reduce using chemicals by 50% by 2030. So it's all these targets, isn't it? Yeah, it's a tricky one. But I mean, obviously, we've still got likes of glyphosate, Roundup, still on sale, which in many European countries
was being banned.
So are we just getting slow here? I don't know. Or is there too much pressure from you know, the farming community to keep the products around so it helps them obviously do their job? I don't know. It's a very contentious subject, I think, really. But also, there's some very very positive things about it, though, isn't there, Peter, about the fact that, obviously, the British kite mark, obviously...
Yes, plants will have a kite mark on soon.
Yeah.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all sort of familiar, certainly, at the garden centre here, of obviously, British-grown stock, because there's usually a little Union Jack on there, which is worth looking out for. But, something to help, and that might help the health standards of these plants as well, because obviously with DEFRA now heavily involved in making sure our plants are healthy and safe, that we can do that as well.
And they've also promised to make the sort of recycling better, and identical waste streams, so hopefully that means that the green waste that the councils collect can all be treated the same, and also you hope they do it with all the other recycling things. I mean, the blue top bins that we have, allowing customers to put their plant pots in them.
And maybe uniformity across all the different counties, because obviously Northampton's different to Buckingham, which is probably different to Oxford. So let's make it easier for people, not more difficult. So some positives out of this, but obviously I think even the RHS Director General there, Claire Matteson, said she was disappointed, which about it. So, you know, and that's obviously the main charity of horticulture in the UK. So
that's the voice that the government turned to, isn't it, when they want some help?
Yes,
but they're ignoring us. And we've got more gardens being opened in Scotland.
It is, yes. So we often talk about the National Garden Scheme in England and Wales. Well, north of the border, 50 new gardens, Peter, are going to be welcoming visitors for the first time.
And that's Scotland's Garden Scheme. SGS.
SGS rather than our NGS.
NGS. That's brilliant.
So they're looking like, it's good to get more into the mix. But they're saying that more than 75,000 visitors were attracted to around 400 gardens.
Wow.
Last year. And raising just short of, £289,000 for like a perennial. Maggie's and the Queen's Nursing Institute of Scotland. So
that's good, because perennials the sort of charity for our industry, isn't it?
It
is. Helps out sort of for those that are getting a bit old and in need of help.
Indeed,
who've worked in the horticultural industry. Yes, it's a good charity, isn't it?
It is, and it's interesting, Peter, because there's going to be a new hydrangea
launched
to fundraise for perennial, and that's going to. So during this course of this year, when you go into the garden centre and nurseries, you will see a variety called Hydrangea Cherry Explosion.
Okay.
It's been grown by the, I think it's White Wyvale Nurseries. They produce a lot of plants. I mean, we get quite a lot of plants from them through the course of the year. And hopefully we'll be stocking this wonderful macrophylla type. So this is one of the mophead types, you know, the sort of wonderful mophead varieties. Which are so popular these days.
And I guess with a name like Cherry, that's going to be a red one, isn't it?
Yeah, Cherry Explosion, It's going to be very descriptive, yes. And great for growing, you know, in the border or growing a pot and things. Hydrangeas are just such adaptable plants, aren't they? So
adaptable so long as they're in a lime-free compost.
Most definitely, yes, yeah. apart from the rules about pruning them, which, of course, you've just got to be careful of, but it's a lovely plant, and knowing how many we tend to sell through the course of the year. It's obviously, you know, the plant of the moment. I was thinking the A to Z, you know, the shrubs, you know, Hebes and hydrangeas between them sort of battled out for for the top spot.
Yeah. Well, Hebes are great for foliage colour, aren't they?
Most
they're
definitely,
a nice little plant, aren't they?
Oh yeah, most definitely, yeah.
Cool.
And yeah, so on as we're talking about flowers, let's talk about Britain in Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this is the headline from Garden News magazine. It's the final countdown. So basically, all the finalists have been named, and so obviously we'll wait with bated breath to find out who the winner is of each of them. So they have various categories: so village, large village, small town, town. Yeah. So there's plenty of different opportunities there. So we will see, and we'll bring you the winners. When we get them, so that's all done through through the RHS, so it's going to keep them busy over the next few months as well.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Isn't it always nice to see a good garden?
It is indeed, yes. And yeah, I mean, I noticed, Upton in Bloom in Northamptonshire, your neck of the woods,
yeah, not far from
there.
Me,
is there, and it's a very diverse. You know, there doesn't seem to be any favouritism, you know, geographically wise, which is great. So. Plenty to go out there as well, too.
Brilliant.
And one more big bit of news on the show front, and links into our wonderful chat with Peter White a few podcasts ago. Our
orchids.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the International Orchids show is going to move and shine at the BBC Gardeners Wildlife.
Show.
Yes.
That'll be good for them, because in Gardeners Wildlife, such a busy show, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it's obviously got the food side of it as well now, and I guess orchids being so popular will probably attract a big load of, as well.
I think it's a really good move, to be honest with you. And you're going to hopefully popularise the, you know, everything other, you know, other types of orchids as well, because there'll be a whole gamut of species on display there. So that might just nicely tune into people's anxiousness to grow something a little bit different, perhaps. So, it's usually, previously it was held at the Malvern Agricultural Show. So, geographically, it's moving to the centre of the country in a way, isn't it? As well. So, hopefully, they'll get a bigger audience, which of course will be good for the orchid group and
and all the visitors that they get there. We'll see some more exotic orchids.
Better value for your entrance fee too. So so that's good news, and that obviously happens in June. So
brilliant. I look forward to that then.
Yeah.
Cool. And with spring in the air, bedding season, so time to think about petunias.
But
a very interesting one potentially being developed in the US at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I saw the headline. I did think, are we on the 1st of April? I know this podcast is going on the 1st, but this is definitely not an April Fool's. This is Glowing Petunia is launched in US. So,
I can't believe it. No. It's brilliant. I love a glow-in-the-dark plant or star or something to stick on the ceiling. But this is, I suppose you'll be able to do glow-in-the-dark flower arrangements.
Yes, that takes on a whole new gamut of inspirations. So basically, it's the mushroom genes. The mushroom has been used as the carrier for this bioluminescent. Is that the term?
Luminescent. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Which is the ability to genetically engineer important relevant genes from naturally occurring mushrooms and splicing them into the genomes of a petunia. So I suppose potentially you could do it with anything if this technology works, which obviously it does.
It's brilliant. I think the name's the best bit.
Yeah.
Firefly. Petunia Firefly.
Yeah, it has a good ring about it, doesn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's going to be a white flower plant, and apparently in America it's going to be sold for $29 or about £23 or thereabouts.
Okay.
We'll put the link on, and the link is really interesting because you get some really good images of it. So
awesome.
It's a slightly different one, and it's not an April Fool's joke officially.
Well, we don't think it is.
Well, we don't.
We don't know. And not glow in the dark this time, but roses. They're in the news again, aren't they?
Yes, so this is Peter Beale's Roses. They're bringing out a new variety of rose called With Courage, and it looks set to raise £40,000 to help the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, the RNLI, which they always seem to be in the news, certainly when I'm watching the TV these days. And it's a collaboration between Peter Beals and this obviously this charity, and it's to commemorate the charity's 200th anniversary.
Brilliant. Now, looking at the picture, I'm going to say, is that a floribunda?
It looks, a classic.
A sort of multi-petaled flower, isn't it?
Floribundas have had a bit of a... They used, at one point, when I was at college, they reclassified them as what they call cluster-flowered.
Right.
But I think we now call them floribundas again, so I don't know what's happening. People can't decide, but very, very, it's not your... It's not your Valentine's rose, is it? It's something a bit more open, bigger.
They're bigger flowers, generally.
Yeah, bigger, looser flower, isn't it? In many respects, and lots of them. You don't just get sort of one solitary flower; you get a wonderful cluster of them. Mm-hmm. So this one's a coppery orange double flower, good foliage, compact growing, gets to about a metre tall. And it has peachy tones to the outer petals, yellow accents, and a sweet apple scent. Sounds divine, doesn't it?
Well, I like the fact that it's resilient to summer heat and can go down nice and cold as well. So potentially a good one, not just for the UK, but further all afield. Across sort of Europe and further afield.
And maybe this is the start, although the press information doesn't say, but this is the start of maybe breeding roses to be more resilient, perhaps, which we know that we've already reported, haven't we, earlier on last year, that David Austin is retiring quite a lot of their popular varieties, like Munster Wood, which is just not good enough with our hot summers. So
I think that's it, isn't it? There's a big sway of people who are now going sort of to more natural and resilient varieties that can cope with our current conditions and letting the, dare I say it, dainty, less robust plants sort of to pass by the wayside now. I suppose it's good. I mean, it'll reduce our use of pesticides and fungicide, so why not?
Indeed. And it's interesting, isn't it, Peter, that a lot of the cut flower roses which come into the country tend to come from places like South Africa.
Yeah.
So those varieties are obviously being bred nicely to withstand the resilience of heat. So it is doable, isn't it? It's just a matter of maybe just bringing that sort of technology and that breeding programs to the masses, really, to give us the best possible chance.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully raise some money for the RNLI as well.
Indeed. So you will see this rose, I'm sure, in great depth on the Chelsea coverage next month in May. Yeah.
Great stuff. And we also found an article on changes to global food production, haven't we? There's a sort of push towards, or push away from monocultures and the great, I'm going to say, sort of millions of acres of single crops to a more diverse planting, and how the benefits of that, what the benefits are to nature by doing that, which you can understand, can't you? Because at the moment, on my way to work this morning, I saw oilseed rape out in flower already.
Okay, and you think,
that's early, but equally, the bees have only just started flying. Right. Bumblebees have been out a week or two, but sort of honeybees and the normal pollinators have only just started. So if all you're relying on is oilseed rape as a farmer and your pollination's not good this spring, it's going to be a hard summer, isn't it?
So small-scale diversification, isn't it? Having more different crops on the land and linking into what grows well in the locality as well. So
Forcing the wrong thing to grow in the sort of land that you've got.
And I mean, this article is actually in Amateur Gardening magazine, which I didn't expect to see it in, to be honest with you, because it's something you might have read in the newspapers.
Farmers Weekly or something like that.
But there it was. And I mean, that's quite a stark interest that, we are, as a nation, growing obviously more of our own vegetables on allotments or in small scale in our own gardens. And this, in a way, is a way of exemplifying that to the commercial production, isn't it? And if it's going to mean, saving the environment and helping reaping financial benefits as well, because remember, there has to be a a financial gain somewhere along the line, doesn't there?
Yes, in our lovely capitalist world.
Indeed, sadly. But yeah, but it's an interesting take, isn't it? I'm sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And did you know, Chris, that according to the Office of Health Economics, an independent research charity, if everyone in England ate a plant-based diet, it could save the NHS an estimated £6.7 billion a year, with over 2.1 million fewer cases of disease.
That's an interesting fact, isn't it?
We're all going to become vegetarian.
Yes. Is that going to happen, Peter?
I love my bacon sandwich.
Yes.
I know I probably shouldn't say that, but yeah, I do.
Yeah, you said it. Fine. It's fine. But no, I mean, it's the ideal world, but no, we've got to have diversification in what we eat, hasn't it?
And a balanced diet, I think. Not just plants.
I really enjoyed my plants in my roast dinner yesterday, I have to say. I had six different vegetables on the plate.
Perfect. What could be better?
So you see, I'm doing my bit then, aren't I?
Brilliant. So, yeah. Good stuff.
Yes.
And I like the title of this one, Backyard Biodiversity. It's a good report, isn't it?
It sort of says it all, doesn't it, really?
Definitely. Yes, yeah. So this is all about how different environments change the temperature.
Yes, basically, yeah. And it's some new research by the University of Surrey, and they've basically said botanical gardens and wetlands are amongst the best ways to cool our cities in the future.
I suppose they're the right colours. They absorb the heat, do they? And the
canopies, I suppose, tree canopies, shade.
It
makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So they give some stats. And also in the article, Peter, there's a new report, Every Garden Matters. It's a new document from the garden charity Garden Organics. And they want to look at the collective power of every garden in as much of what, you know, the plants you put in there, the combination of plants, and how that can affect our wildlife. So, yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So these are two quite strong reports, which obviously came out the same week.
Yeah.
But it's all good. It's all good stuff. It's all making us talk about the sort of
factors, biodiversity and, like you say, sort of the more different types of things we've got going on in the garden, presumably the more bugs and wildlife we're going to attract
and feed as well, aren't we? So that
also helps.
It's brilliant. So, and also they're suggesting, as we all know, that obviously we're to recycle, which we obviously do, and to give our gardens plenty of habitats for the different insects we want to attract, which I'm sure as we get into spring and summer now we'll be doing anyway, because we'll be putting in lots of plants which are going to benefit those plant pollinators.
And the RHS have come up with a disease ranking, the top 10 gardening problems in 2023.
So the way this works, Peter, is the RHS basically asks their members to report their problem diseases through the year.
So this isn't your whitefly or your blackfly or caterpillars. This is just sort of bacterial infections, fungal infections, those
black leaves, or anything, things which go very wrong and which are very frustrating. So, so there's 10 there. So, we'll work from number 10 to number 1.
Please.
So, number 10 is slime flux. I'm not aware of that. Number 9 is tulip fire.
That's not where the tulips are catching fire now, is it?
No, that's a virus disease of some description, if I remember rightly. So it's number 8 is pocket plum, which obviously affects the prunus family. Number 7 is Phytophthora root rots, which that's something I can all relate
Phytophthora
to.
Phytophthora we've heard of here quite a bit.
We have a bit, when things go wrong, especially with houseplants, if your houseplant is ailing. At joint 5, we've got blossom wilt of fruit trees and bacterial leaf spot and canker of prunus.
Canker, I've definitely heard of. That's a quite common one. We used to spray for that, I seem to remember, years ago, but not anymore.
No, sadly not. No. Number 4, we've got pear rust.
Okay.
I can relate to that. I had it on my pears a couple of years ago.
Yep.
Number 3, rose black spot.
Very common.
Yeah. Number 2, apple and pear scab.
Right, okay.
And number 1, honey fungus.
I'm surprised potato rust isn't in there.
Yeah, and any of the blights, actually, yes.
Yeah, because I'd have thought, I mean, that's quite a common one. That...
Yeah, potato, tomato, last year especially, because it was so wet and humid and such like, I don't know, it seems strange, but that's... Well, that's
the RHS ranking. Well, maybe they're sort of a bit more advanced than our standard gardener. That's why they get these weird slime flux. I've never even heard of it. It's an interesting one.
Ghostbusters or something, I don't know.
So I guess that's all due to wet weather, and hopefully this year it'll be a bit drier.
We'll
get a nice summer and we won't get so many issues.
Yeah, maybe the pests come out to play this year to cause more problems for us, maybe. Yes.
Cool. Okay, now time in the show for our top five. It's a sort of seasonal one at the moment now, isn't it, Chris? Grass seed.
Yes, well, I thought, April is the time you go out and do a bit of overseeding or reseeding or maybe create a completely new lawn from seed. So,
okay, so what's the perfect conditions to sow your grass seed in?
Well, I was always taught at college, April showers, so a warm
Want a nice moist soil.
Yeah.
You rake it up a bit, don't you, on the surface?
Roughen it up so
the seed doesn't all sit on the top.
Correct. And then you need to make sure that you obviously choose the right type of lawn seed for your location. So
Because there's lots of different ones, isn't there? There's like children's ones, general purpose, fine ones, and
ones for shade. Obviously some which have to have wildflowers in as well, so you've got a whole right
That's
mixture.
That's true, yeah, not thought of those.
So you've got a right mixture. And then, of course, you've got to choose a nice still day to do it.
So temperature's quite critical as well from memory, isn't it? Is it above 10 degrees?
Yeah, which we are seeing now through much of March. The day temperatures have moved up quite sharp. Towards the end of March, we were very good, weren't we? We got to 16, 18 degrees on some days.
Certainly yesterday I was out in the garden in my T-shirt.
Yeah.
It was lovely.
And as I say, my usual barometer, the dandelions are flowering, so you know that the soil temperature's lifted enough to spark those seeds off. So,
Grass seed then.
Yeah, so at number five, grass seed, it's tough grass. So tough grass basically is a product which has the proven ability to create a dog patch resistant lawn and tough enough to basically withstand the wear and tear of the family. So
is that going to have lots of ryegrass in it rather than lots of fescues? Or
That's it. Yeah, it's got a good ryegrass mix. Johnson's, when I was reading the little bit about it, they did lots of research over in Denmark to get the right sort of mix.
Yep.
So it's been really well trialled. And each variety was trialled with the dog urine mixtures. Too much detail here,
perhaps.
Well,
that's a lot of dogs in the country, so it's good if you can have slightly more resistant lawn.
And obviously it works. So that's a strong place at number five. At number four, again, it's just two different sizes. So we've got grass seed general purpose. It is a general purpose mix, so perfect for new lawns, overseeding, and obviously covering those patches as well. And at number three, we've got grass seed anytime.
Okay.
And of course, anytime germinates when the soil reaches +3, so it means you can literally sow it at any time. The clue's in the name, isn't it?
That's interesting. Yeah, it's good then.
And it produces the sward it produces is really dark green. So if you want a really dark, luscious lawn, it's a good
variety. That's a good one. Yeah.
And it's hard wearing as well. So
fair enough.
Great for the kids and possibly the dogs as well.
Yeah.
Number two, grass seed general, but a much larger size, 420 grams. And then, surprise, surprise, grass seed anytime. A larger pack taking the top slot. So
any time and general purpose are the go-to. And then if you've got a dog, get some tough grass.
You did.
That's interesting. That's fun.
So plenty, and if you're doing any, try and plan your lawn care. Try and get your lawn up to speed. And then before you do your grass, any re-sowings, try and do it sort of the last thing really, if you can, in the scheme of things. That's what I try and do.
Yeah, because you're not meant to sort of put any fertilisers down on the lawn for a few weeks after sowing, are you?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so at least probably a month or so after doing that. But perfect conditions now for your lawn seed to germinate, and the benefits will be plentiful, hopefully.
Well, it gets rid of all those slightly balder patches, shall we
indeed.
Perfect. Great stuff. Thanks, Chris. And with the sort of weather warming up now, it was really time to get cracking on. I had some fun with James the other week planting up some seeds.
Excellent.
So we're hopefully going to have some nice sunflowers growing this year at
that
the bottom of the garden.
Sounds good. Yes, yeah. No, that's good, Peter. And yes, seed sowing does take the precedence at the moment as well. But it's worth just mentioning, I mean, we were talking about spring flowers earlier, about obviously our daffodils and tulips being hit by slug damage.
Yep.
We've also seen issues with the box blight, because it's been so mild this winter, causing a lot of problems. I know, talking to our customers here anecdotally and looking at my own box at home, it's certainly been the perfect.
It's pretty strange. I find it really interesting, because certain sort of area, you walk around a village and 80% of it's suffering, and then there'll be odd patches that just still seem pristine box. But how do you tell the difference between, because it's got two issues at the moment, hasn't it? You've got box blight and you've got a sort of bacterial disease
as well. Yes.
So what are the things to look out for?
Yeah, I mean, if your box starts to go yellow and then it defoliates, so you start to see sort of bare stems, that can be either of the problems.
Right.
What differentiates it normally is if you do a little bark test, so if you scratch away and see a little bit of green, that generally means it's the bacterial disease. So potentially trimming the plants back to some nice green growth means that the plant might recover.
Okay.
If it's box blight, then generally the whole strand of the stem will go, and of course the stem will be either brown or black and won't regrow.
So I guess with boxes being very trainable, shall we say,
a bit of topiary.
Can actually sort of cut them back hard and potentially reform your box ball or your square shape after a long period. Or
I'd say potentially. It just depends how quickly you can catch it. And the problem with some of these bacterial diseases, you turn away and within, literally 2 or 3 days, the whole plant can have taken a real bad turn. So a couple of things I would do, Peter. I think in that instance, get some feed into the plant. We're into April now, so you can feed
growing
away.
Growing season, isn't it?
And then maybe get yourself something like Fungus Fighter, which is obviously a really good systemic fungicide, and spray the whole of the plant. Follow the recommendations on the box and do that on a regular basis, because that will help to prevent the box blight then hitting the plant again.
Okay, so they're not all quite ready to be pulled up and replanted yet.
I'm just hoping that my situation at home means I might have to save some of it, but I think in a way the writing is in the wall if you get a really bad batch. And of course, if the integrity of your hedge line is really badly hit, then...
Well, I think that's the sad thing. You go around places and you just see entire hedges that have just been totally... Yeah. But is it the same regardless of the size of the box? Because certainly the ones that I'm seeing all tend to be two foot tall. I've not seen any really big sort of 8-10 foot box plants being affected yet.
Yeah, I think it does really discriminate against size, but I think you're right. I think the smaller ones, because they're being heavily trimmed and trained and manicured and things, they're more likely, because of course they're more exposed to being cut. And of course that's the thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's how the bacteria gets in into.
Hence, that's why we normally say if you're going to cut your box, it's going to be sort of, Derby Day, traditionally June onwards, is the time to do it.
Okay, that's useful. And worst case scenario, you're pulling them out. What would you recommend replanting with?
So if it's a box hedge, there's a couple of really good plants on the market now. There's Euonymus, both Jean Hughes and Green Spire, two really good plants. Anybody who's grown Euonymus in the garden know they're toughies.
Yeah,
they're very good. If you want something a little bit more open, a little bit more, shall we say, utilitarian, then evergreen honeysuttle hedging.
Okay, yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's a good doer, and it can be trimmed hard back and that recovers.
Yep.
And then if you want something a little bit more flowery, then either lavender or hedge germander, two-crumb, would give you a really nice little flowery hedge.
Well, lavender hedges I love because of the smell. Oh, you walk past them in sort of end of summer and you've got the beautiful old flowers dying back and the smell's just glorious, isn't
it? So it's not all bad news, really. There's plenty, and these euonymus now look like they're going to sort of take the world by storm, judging by the number of people who are wanting to plant them. And, so which is good. But, it's sad, isn't it? And... so the other thing I was going to say, Peter, as we're walking around gardens now, of course, magnolias, I'm sure, through the month of March have been really good. As we go into April, they've done really well. We've had a good spring for them, really. We've not had any particularly nasty frosts, and which, of course, tenderly browns the flowers, which obviously makes a bit of a...
Is that why you quite often see the tips of them sort of going brown?
That's the frost, yeah.
That's the frost, is it? Yeah.
And cold winds can do that as well. So it's been obviously generally mildish, and we've had some chillier days, but generally the day temperatures have been higher, and that's what's brought the magnolias on. I think it's been a real vintage year for them, to be honest with you.
Yeah, certainly my neighbour's one's looking beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I noticed the dwarf magnolia with the white flowers.
Yep.
Absolutely smothered this year. I mean, normally they do well, but this year I thought, wow, that's done really, really well.
I suspect that's stellata, isn't it? That's the star magnolia. That's the one with the little flowers.
Little flowers.
Yeah, and the thing is that it doesn't grow tree. I mean, it will become a small tree, but it takes a long time. But as a shrub, even if you've got a large pot, you can grow one of those really well. You don't need a huge garden to grow a magnolia, that's for sure.
Interesting. Thank you.
So I suppose it's those little tasks for April as we're recording this, and Easter is upon us. It's the traditional time to do certain things. So I would say certainly get out there and do a bit of tidying of your borders now. Now you can start to see lots of new growth. So those little sedums can be trimmed back and opened up. If you've been planting any new trees over winter, make sure they're all nicely secure. We get those spring gales now. Now the plants are putting on leaves, you see. They do act a bit like a large sail. So
starts getting a bit more wind resistance, so they need firming in properly.
Yeah, so make sure the buckle ties are nice and safe as well. And then, of course, like we mentioned earlier about daffodils, give them a bit of a tidy up, do a bit of deadheading and give them a bit of feed as well. If you really like your daffs, a bit of granular fertiliser.
Okay,
Of either Vitax Q4 or a bit of sulfate of potash or a bit of the empathy, the root grow after plant. You could put some of that around as well, just to help them along. So they would be good.
Brilliant.
Weeds. Dare I
make use always the word, weeds.
The weeds, yeah. So get the hoe out. I was giving my hoe a bit of a clean up the other day on Saturday with an oily rag just to get that blade ready. So keep that moving, of course. That type of weed, hand weeding is the most productive way of controlling them, especially when the plants are young seedlings. In the greenhouse, it's seed sowing, really, isn't it? So obviously things like your sweet peas, if you're growing a lot of bedding plants, I mean, April is a really good month to do things like marigolds and cosmos, and there's lots of gazanias. I mean, there's plenty of things you can do. I mean, they'll be in flower probably for the end of May, June, but you'll get a head start if you don't want to buy lots of bedding.
Well, it's so much cheaper if you can grow some bedding from seed, isn't it? And you get a really good display, and I always find it more rewarding.
You just
feel a bit more pride about the fact you've grown it from seed.
The three things I like to grow from seed, either buying cheating a little bit and buying the little Kinder seedlings, is geraniums, ordinary pelargoniums, marigolds from seed, and nasturtiums. If I can grow those three things each year, work is done. I just feel a lot of satisfaction the fact I've nurtured them, and they've made really nice big plants, and they've done their job. So get plenty of things in there. I think people talk about hardening off the plants in April, so as we get halfway through this month, you might start wanting to acclimatise your things you've grown on the windowsill and the greenhouse.
Well, what I do, Chris, is I generally, obviously being at work most of the week, you don't get to do this often, but with my seedlings, I tend, if it's not too windy and it's a fairly warm day, I'll put them outside for a few hours and then bring them back in, and then sort of when I next remember, put them out for a bit longer and just expose them to a small amount of wind.
That's it.
And open them up. And that definitely does make a difference when you then take them down the allotment and plant them up. They don't fall over.
Indeed. They need toughening up. Yeah, I mean, if you do that over a couple of weeks, that's ideal, isn't it? I mean, sometimes it's not practical, but you want to create a little bit of a stronger plant as well. Spring bedding, well, of course, everything is moving on. I mean, I was cleaning up some of my primroses on Saturday.
Yep.
Lots of flowers are already finished, so go along, do a bit of deadheading, remove those spent blooms, and there's loads of new buds coming underneath, so it's worth spending, 5-10 minutes each day just going along, especially if you've got lots of pots and, if you've got some hanging baskets. Mm-hmm. Spend a bit of time doing that, and of course that means your display will look nicer until you're ready to do your change over to summer bedding as well, which is good. Vegetables sowing wise, well, yeah, I mean, we're into that season now, so everything goes really, but things like parsnips and carrots would be good, and obviously all your salads. There's just so many things to sow, isn't there? That's the thing. But just make sure you've got a nice bright spot. Doing some little direct pinch sowings into little cells is a really good way, especially if you've got some nice plugs of veggie plants for your allotment. That's a good way of building up your stock. And obviously you'll have probably more of the plants than you need, so share them with your mates on the plot if you can. Mm. It's always a good way of a conversational opener, isn't it?
Give them away and then they get to try a new variety. I think that's one of the best things, is when you give someone a little seedling and it turns into a plant and they think, well, I actually really enjoy growing that.
Exactly.
It's a good one. It's a great way to share the knowledge.
Most definitely. And also, if you are doing sowings directly to the soil, direct sowings, then make sure you're thinning out and giving the plants a little bit of space then to develop. I mean, generally, the thinner you can sow, well, obviously, the less seeds you use, which is good, but also it means you haven't got potential issues with pests being attracted. I mean, if I'm thinking of carrots here, if you start thinning your carrots out, the little carrot fly sniffs
smells
them out, off she comes and creates havoc. So if you can avoid any major thinnings, that's good as well. Mm. One thing you might want to consider as well is wildflowers. So we have a little wildflower patch at home, and we've just put a lot more seed down over the last couple of months.
Okay.
The seedlings are starting to appear now, but it's differentiating the seeds from the weeds, and that can be a bit tricky. So everything has to just grow. But obviously, if you can buy packets of seed, you can get some nice little plug plants going as well now. I mean, they'll germinate very, very quickly. Or you might go to a nursery where they've got little wildflower plug plants. That's another good way of building up your numbers. But I think if we put a few wildflowers in, so much the better. I mean, cowslips have been amazing this spring, and that's one which you can sow next month in May to provide nice plants for next year.
Perfect.
And hanging baskets are probably a little bit early, but if you've got a greenhouse or a porch, then maybe now's
the
time.
A bit of protection, you can start growing them.
Yeah, yeah. So obviously buy your little young plants. I've noticed we're starting to get the sort of 9 centimetre bigger than sort of the kinder plants in. Now they're starting to arrive, so get those in. It means obviously you put less plants in. If you use kinder plants, you tend to put more plants in a hanging basket, which sometimes isn't necessary, but we tend to cram them in.
Well, it makes a better display.
It does sometimes. But be aware of that. And obviously just make sure your compost has a bit of one of these water retaining gels if you're worried about the compost drying out, or a bit of a slow release or continuous release fertilizer to give your hanging baskets the best possible start as well. Herb gardens. If your herb garden might need a bit of a revamp after the winter.
Yep.
Especially some of the more sort of tender. I mean, most herbs are Mediterranean, and I'm sure they're not used to the amount of rain we've had over the winter, so you might need to do some replacement planting.
Well, and a bit of weeding, I think, always around the pots as well. Mm. It's always amazing how many weeds get to grow over winter.
Definitely, yes. And my last tip really, Peter, is good old comfrey feed.
It's sprouting again, my two plants that you gave me. They're good. Doing well.
Good. Yeah, well, I'm coming to the end of my comfrey in my water butt there. It's coming to the end, so I'm going to be using that over the next few weeks to give everything a bit of a kick start. But that's the thing, if you've not got some comfrey, get yourself some comfrey plants going, And you'll be producing some nice comfrey tea by, what, July, August, if you're looking. Or maybe a bit...
Well, if I can grow them, it can't be that hard.
Indeed. So, plenty to be getting on with, Peter, this merry month of April.
Perfect. Brilliant. Well, thanks for all the tips, Chris.
Pleasure,
lots of jobs to get on with.
Yeah, we better get out there to get on.
That's it. We just need a bit of time off work now and get the allotment sorted out. That's brilliant. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Today's show was brought to you by Buckingham Garden Centre and Nurseries. The show was hosted by Chris Day and Peter Brown. The show was produced by Peter Brown. And our thanks to Chilton Music Therapy for providing the music. Thanks for listening.
At Chilton Music Therapy, we want everyone to know the difference that music can make in their lives. From parents and their premature babies in hospital to grandparents with dementia. We provide music therapy and community music services to people of all ages and needs across England. We work both digitally and in person in people's homes, care homes, schools, hospitals and hospices. Find out more at chilternmusictherapy.co.uk.